Lost Horizon by James Hilton. Jeffrey Matthews reads the fourth of 10 episodes.
Conway and Mallinson of the Consular Service, together with Miss Brinklow, a missionary, and an American called Barnard, had been flown out of a trouble spot in North India. But the pilot was not the RAF officer they knew and expected. He was a stranger who flew them east into the wildest heights of Tibet, crash-landed and died, leaving them to seek shelter in the strange monastery at Shangri-La, to which they were brought by a lama called Chang.
We desire nothing more, Mr. Conway, than that you and your companions should enjoy every moment of your stay here. Tomorrow you will find Shangri-La even more interesting. If you are fatigued, you will find there are few better places in the world.
Next day, Conway didn't pass on to his friends his conclusion that their arrival had been in some way expected by the inhabitants of Shangri-La. One part of him still insisted there was something distinctly odd about the place, that the attitude of Chang was far from reassuring, and that the party were virtually prisoners. But the truth was that the puzzle of Shangri-La and of his own arrival there was beginning to exercise a fascination over him. And when he rose in the morning and saw the soft blue of the sky through his window, he wouldn't, as Chang had predicted, have chosen to be anywhere else on earth. He was glad to find that on Barnard and Miss Brinklow a night's rest had had a heartening effect. Even Mallinson had acquired a touch of grudging complacency. "I suppose we shan't get away today, after all," he said, "unless somebody looks pretty sharp about it." "I think we'd better wait and see what the day brings," said Conway. "Perhaps it was too optimistic to expect them to do anything last night." As they were finishing breakfast, Chang entered, and, with a little bow, began the exchange of politely conventional greetings. Mallinson waited impatiently until Conway and the lama had stopped speaking. Then he said, "Now, about those porters. I want to start hunting round for them right away. This morning, if you've no objection."
"But, my dear Mr. Mallinson, I am sorry to tell you that it would be of little use. I fear we have no men available who would be willing to accompany you so far from their homes."
"But great Scott, man, you don't suppose you're going to take that for an answer, do you?"
"I'm afraid he's right, Chang," said Conway. "This sort of prevarication won't do, you know. We can't stay indefinitely, and we can't get away by ourselves. What, then, do you propose?"
"My dear sir, may I make this suggestion? From time to time we receive consignments of goods from across the mountains. Such a consignment is expected to arrive shortly. As the men who make the delivery will afterwards return, it seems to me that you might manage to come to some arrangement with them. Indeed, I cannot think of any other plan."
"When do they arrive?" said Mallinson.
"The exact date is, of course, impossible to forecast. You have yourself had experience of the difficulty of movement in this part of the world. It might be a month from now, probably not more than 2 months."
2 months? Said Mallinson. 2 months in this place? It's preposterous! Conway, you surely can't agree to that!"
"I am sorry," said Chan. "I do not wish to offend. Lamasri continues to offer all of you its utmost hospitality for as long as you have the misfortune to remain. I can say no more."
And, gathering his gown about him in a little gesture of finality, he left them. They spent the rest of the morning discussing the matter. "I'm past arguing about it," said Mallinson. "You know how I feel. I've said all along there's something very strange about this business. It's crooked. I'd like to be out of it."
"You may be right," said Conway. But it looks as though we shall have to do as Chang suggested. We are virtually helpless. As for me, I don't see why 2 months here should be much worse than 2 months in any other isolated part of the world. We shall be missed, and we shall all have our names in the papers, but I can't think of anybody who will worry over me acutely. He turned to the others, as if inviting them to state their own cases. Mallinson offered no information, but Conway knew roughly how he was situated. He had parents and a girl in England. It made things hard. Barnard, on the other hand, accepted the situation with his habitual good humour.
"Well, reckon I'm pretty lucky myself, for that matter. 2 months in the penitentiary won't kill me. The folks in my hometown won't wink an eyelid."
After their discussion, they all felt more settled in their minds, and when Chang approached them after lunch, none of them felt disposed to continue the squabble. He suggested they might care to be shown a little more of the Lamasery buildings. Shangri-La was not the first monastic institution Conway had inspected, but it was easily the largest and the most remarkable. He was enchanted. He recognized treasures that museums and millionaires would have bargained for. In the library, lofty and spacious, between 20,000 and 30,000 books were housed in bays and alcoves. Mallinson, who had picked up a volume, said, "I say, Conway, here's a map of the country.
We have a collection of several hundred maps," said Chang. "They are all open to your inspection, but perhaps I can save you trouble in one respect. You will not find Shangri-La marked on any."
"That's curious," said Conway. "I wonder why."
"There is a very good reason. I'm afraid that is all I can say. Perhaps you will now like to take tea?"
The party fell in with the suggestion. They followed Chang through several courtyards to a scene of quite sudden and unmatched loveliness. From a colonnade, steps descended to a garden. Here, a lotus pool lay entrapped, the leaves so closely set they gave an impression of a floor of moist green tiles. Fringing the pool were posed a brass menagerie of lions, dragons, and unicorns. Chang led the way into an open pavilion, which, to Conway's further delight, contained a harpsichord and a modern grand piano.
"You mean to tell me," said Barnard, "this piano was brought here by the route we came along yesterday?"
"There is no other," said Chang.
Then servants came forward with shallow bowls of scented tea. Along with the Tibetans, there also entered a girl in Chinese dress. She went at once to the harpsichord and began to play an 18th-century gavotte. As soon as the piece was finished, she bowed slightly and went out.
"You are pleased, Mr. Conway," said Chang.
"Who is she?" said Mallinson.
"Her name is Lo Tseng. She has much skill with Western keyboard music. Like myself, she has not yet attained the full initiation into the Lamahood."
"I should think not indeed," said Miss Brinklow. "She looks hardly more than a child. So, you have women lamas, then?"
"Yes, Miss Brinklow. There are no sex distinctions among us."
The rest of the tea drinking proceeded without conversation. Echoes of the harpsichord seemed still in the air, posing a strange spell. Presently, Chang led the way from the pavilion.
"I hope the tour has been enjoyable," he said, "and please consider the resources of the music room and library wholly at your disposal throughout your stay."
That evening, after dinner, Conway left the others and strolled out into the calm, moon-washed courtyards. Shangri-La was lovely then. The air was cold and still, and the mountain that towered behind the Lamasery seemed much nearer than by day. But despite the beauty of the scene, Conway was ill at ease. He was puzzled. The half-truths and evasions that their questions had evoked hinted
at strange possibilities. The whole amazing series of events that had happened to him and his three chance companions had swung into a sort of focus. He couldn't yet understand them, but he believed now that an explanation did exist. Passing along a cloister, he reached the terrace that looked over the valley. He gazed over the edge into the blue-black emptiness. The drop was horrifying, perhaps as much as a mile. He wondered if he would be allowed to descend and inspect the valley civilization that Chang had spoken of. Suddenly, on a flutter of air, there came sounds far below. Conway listened intently. He could hear gongs and trumpets, and also, though perhaps only in imagination, a massed wail of voices. The sounds faded on a veer of the wind, then returned, only to fade again. Two Tibetans had padded across the terrace and were idling near the parapet. Good-humoured fellows, they looked. Then, from far, far below in the valley, the whisper of gongs and trumpets rose again. And Conway heard one of the men question his companion. The answer came. They have buried Palu. Conway, whose knowledge of Tibetan was very slight, hoped they would continue talking. He couldn't gather much from a single remark, and indeed, after a pause, other snatches of the conversation drifted across the courtyard.
He died outside. Talu came through the air over the great mountains. Strangers he brought also.
Though he went outside long ago, Shangri-La remembers him still.
He obeyed the High Ones of Shangri-La.
Nothing more was said that Conway could interpret, and after waiting some time he went back to his own quarters. But he had heard enough to turn a key in the locked mystery. It had, of course, crossed his mind, but he had never really accepted it. Now he saw that, however fantastic it seemed, it must be accepted. That runaway flight had not been the meaningless exploit of a madman. It had been something planned, prepared, and carried out at the instigation of someone here at Shangri-La. The dead pirate who had brought them here was known by name to those who lived here. He had been one of them. His death was mourned. Everything that had gone before and everything that was still happening to them pointed to a high-directing intelligence bent upon its own purposes. There had been, as it were, a single arch of intention spanning the inexplicable hours and miles. But what was that intention? For what possible reason could four chance passengers in a British aeroplane be whisked away to this lost Tibetan valley?
That was episode 4 of Lost Horizon by James Hilton. It was read by Geoffrey Matthews.